Our bill author is not here yet, and several of our members are not here. They are tied up in a caucus, but they should be joining us shortly. We do have a quorum that have checked in, so we can begin. And today we're hearing a bill Senator Mary Olson is sponsoring on the Wireless Telephone Consumer Protection Act. But we will have some preliminary information, and because we did hear these bills last year, but it was just basically a bill hearing, and then we laid them over for work during the interim. But we didn't do very much background on wireless information or what the history of wireless legislation has been in the state, what's in the purview of the state, and what is that of relegated over to the federal, I guess the federal government relegates to us, but what is the federal government's responsibility and what's the state responsibility? So I've asked John Fuller to provide an overview of federal law, and then the industry is going to provide some information about wireless, their own overview also. So we'll start with John Fuller, our Senate counsel.
Thank you. It is important to consider federal law because we did have a state law that was passed in 2004, and it was held preempted, and we'll get to that later, because of federal statutory provision. Until about 1993, wireless was regulated the same way as wireline, which is the states had authority to regulate the intrastate aspect of it, and the federal government had the interstate regulation. But that was changed in 1993. And you'll see in your overview there, of the bill summary, there's a cite to the federal law, which I'll talk about a little bit later. But the federal government regulates market entry licensing. They auction the spectrum. They license. There is not a state certificate of authority for wireless. The rate regulation, the state does have some residual authority if the FCC finds upon a petition from the state that the competition is not existing in the state. The FCC has denied all of those petitions, and basically the FCC has let the market set the rates. They have not actively been involved in tariff filings. If you look at your overview, you see on the second paragraph under overview, there is the federal law. No state or local government shall have any authority to regulate the entry, which is the licensing requirements, of or the rates charged by any commercial mobile service, that's a cellular company, except this paragraph shall not prohibit a state from regulating the other terms and conditions of commercial mobile services. That phrase, you might want to underline, the other terms and conditions, is not clearly defined by any court case. That's the area, a lot of gray area. That's the provision that was used by the circuit court in 2005 to hold that our state law, the principal provision of which gave consumers an opportunity to opt out of changes in the contract, it gave them 60 days. The court found that would affect rates if the change was an increase in the rate. Therefore, it was prohibited. They found the law so intertwined that none of the other provisions was allowed to stand despite a general severability provision. So that is the issue. You know, is what we're doing here, as you look at this bill, as you consider amendments, are we within our jurisdiction, which is clearly limited by this law? The Eighth Circuit case in 2005 seemed to narrowly draw it. If you had any impact on a rate, you know, which everything does, you might be limited. There's a recent case which the U.S. Supreme Court did not take for review, which had to do with an FCC declaration, I think in 2005, that provided that states were prohibited from either requiring or limiting items on bills, separate items. You know, they couldn't either say they all had to be combined or had to be separated. And the 11th Circuit held that that was not rate regulation and the states were permitted to do it. So that's an area where the states are allowed to act under that circuit court decision. But there is no clear defining area. There's legislative history back in 96 and 93 and 94 that indicate that the states are free to enact consumer protection law. The issue that the FCC, how they see it, is that if it's a general law, and generally applicable law, then they think that's the dividing line. If it's something specifically targeted at a cellular company, there the FCC has indicated that that's a problem for them, but no courts have adopted that bright line. There's no final decision by U.S. Supreme Court. So that's the federal law. The states have authority. It's limited by this statute. That statute has not been definitely interpreted by the federal courts. Another piece of background information that might be helpful is that our attorney general, in fact, has sued, I think, Sprint Nextel for a violation of our state, I think, deceptive practices or consumer fraud law because of their practices with respect to extending contracts. And so that is pending. And I don't know if the attorney general is going to discuss that, but that's another thing you should have in the back of your mind. We do have general consumer laws that are being applied or sought to be applied against these wireless carriers. So we can tax them. We can require them to participate in various programs, but we cannot set their rates, and we cannot license them. We can regulate the other terms and conditions of the contracts, and that's an unknown area, but it's something.
Thank you. Any questions or comments? Okay. At this time, then, I call on Mike McDermott.
I get my props in order. Hi, I'm Michael McDermott, Madam Chairwoman, members of the committee. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to provide some historical perspective on the history of the wireless industry. I'll try very hard to keep my comments brief, and so we can, with respect to the committee's time, get through this quickly. Our story begins in 1876, which is kind of... We'll start with Alexander Graham Bell inventing the telephone, and then we'll jump to 1983. That is very telling. So for a long time, up until 1983, all of our telecommunications services were wired to the wall. And in 1983, the first wireless phone call was made from the 50-yard line of Soldier Field in Chicago to Alexander Graham Bell's great-grandson in Paris. Now, I say it's one of the few successful completions made in Soldier Field since then, but that's for another day. The FCC in 1986 switched to a lottery system because the first two licensees that were granted the ability to provide wireless service, analog wireless service, were provided that service on spectrum that was given to them by the FCC. All the applicant had to do was to fill out an application for this spectrum, file some paperwork with the FCC, and pay, I think, a $1,500 fee. Then the government realized that the spectrum had value and began in 1986 the lottery to sell the spectrum at auction. And at that time, there was about 1,000 cell sites across America. And in a future slide, I'll show you how that has actually grown exponentially. In 1989, Motorola announced the first mobile, truly mobile cell phone with the advent of the Microtech. It allowed the service to be truly mobile, out of the car. It wasn't tethered to a car or a car battery or a booster in the trunk. I brought some props that demonstrate just how far we've come in a matter of 25 years. You know, this is the old brick phone. I have the bag phone. I could just only imagine having to lug this thing around today. It would be totally out of character. It does represent, I think, the growth of the wireless industry right here in these two devices. And if you compare it against my Juke, which is about the size of a cigarette lighter, I mean, you really have to realize that this is an MP3 player. It can download music over the air. You can go to the internet and search the internet. You can text message. You can do a lot of interesting things with this phone. Also, I have something I'll show you in a few minutes. It's our Voyager, and it has internet connectivity, but it also has streaming live to the phone a cable TV programming. I can watch MSNBC. I can watch CNBC, The Closing Bell. I can watch Nickelodeon and ESPN, live basketball, all cable TV programming without a cable to my phone live. And that shows the commitment that the wireless industry has made to bring new products and services to the marketplace. If you look at the advancements in the wireline telephone, they marked their technology advancements with pulse rotary dial going to touch tone, three-way calling, call forwarding. That was a heavily regulated industry, and they measured their technology advancements in decades, not in week to week, month to month, with new products coming out all the time that our customers have wanted and asked for us to provide. So I provide a little bit of background in terms of the timeline. The council referenced the 1993 Omnibus Reconciliation Act that included language preempting the states from regulating the rates and entry of wireless providers. 1996, the Telecom Act of 1996 was created to design a system with more competition. It allowed for PCS licenses, digital licenses, to be auctioned off, the spectrum to be auctioned off to the carriers. And that, I think, was really the genesis of the technological advances that we have today. You had seven national carriers at that time. Sprint was a standalone company, Nextel. AT&T had its own wireless service. Verizon Wireless, you had Primeco, PCS Primeco, which was a regional provider, U.S. Cellular. So you saw this explosion in the number of wireless providers. And over the time, there's been some reshuffling of the deck, some consolidation in the industry. But without a doubt, there's four national carriers, several super regional carriers like Alltel, U.S. Cellular, as I mentioned, and even some providers that are state-to-state specific. So the consumer does have a lot of choice, and there is a lot of competition in that respect. In 1997, when that explosion had taken place, there was 1,000 direct carrier employment attributed to the industry, 50,000 cell sites across America. The product went from analog to digital. The call quality got a lot better. You didn't have to worry about hearing that crackle on an analog phone saying, hold on, I think I'm going to lose you. Who remembers those days and the first cell phones that were out? You knew that your call was going to drop. Now with the digital technology, you get upset when your call drops because you have come to rely on it and depend on the resiliency and the robust technological advancements we've made to provide that call seamlessly. I'm not saying that there's not a dropped call from time to time, but hopefully not on Verizon Wireless's network. So, and then in 2000, the subscribership exceeded 100 million. Digital wireless outnumbered the analog subscribers. Analog service, it's important to note that yesterday, Verizon Wireless decommissioned our analog network, and we are now a 100% digital provider of wireless telecommunications. We have decided that the money that we were investing in the analog network was not cost effective. It was better to put that money into our programs like bringing EVDO broadband, bringing the next generation of telecommunications to the marketplace instead of supporting the old technology, which was the analog. And the FCC granted us that authority to do that, and yesterday was that benchmark. In 2002, the FCC awarded additional spectrum for advanced wireless services, and we saw the advent of 2.5 generation wireless, which was text messaging and email and whatnot. The council also, and I forgot your name, I'm sorry, the council, committee council.
John Fuller.
Mr. Fuller, I'm sorry, Mr. Fuller. There you go, thank you. Mr. Fuller referenced the spectrum allocation. I won't go into that, but just to reinforce that we've spent billions of dollars, not only as a company, but also as an industry in buying that spectrum at auction from the federal government. On the next page, you have wireless technologies. We talked about analog, the two generation, the digital technology. Verizon has chosen code division multiple access, and it sounds like a really complex thing, and it is, but it's different than the global standard of mobilization, which is what T-Mobile and AT&T have chosen for their platform. Those technologies are not compatible. They don't interface. You can't do the same things on each other's networks because they are they're different engines. They're different engines that run the platform of the wireless company. Nextel had iDEN, which was a push-to-talk product. So each company chose what they thought was going to be in their best interest, invested heavily in that, and stand behind that and support that now. That's why you see a difference. On the next page, there's three cell sites on a graph that shows the framework of how wireless technology works. The cell phone I have here is probably talking to two or three cell sites right now, and it's picked the one that has the strongest signal to connect with and carry the call. But the reason it's talking to three cell sites is because if I become mobile and move from one point to another, either in a vehicle or on a bicycle or if I'm walking, the cell tower that is secondary to it will pick up the stronger signal and then carry it over seamlessly, so you're able to move about down an interstate, down a street, and have a seamless conversation without having the call drop. And that's demonstrated here. I don't want to get into a lot of the technical discussion of backhauling and interconnection. It's really not all that exciting, but I think this does demonstrate that the reason it's cellular is that the calls carry from one cell to another to make the call seamless and fill in all the holes that you might experience when you have a drop call. Most of the drop calls are either due to a gap in the coverage area, sometimes topography, if you have a hill, if you hit a dip in a hill or a road. Also, foliage in the summertime can affect cell signal strength, and also capacity. If you're at a baseball game or a football game and a lot of people are on their phones, sometimes the capacity issue could knock the call out. So there's a lot of factors. In urban areas, you have more cell sites. In rural areas, you have less cell sites. You have taller structures in the rural areas because the signal can carry for several miles. But in downtown St. Paul or downtown Minneapolis, it's much more compact because you have more people using the network.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for Mr. McDermott. On Valentine's Day, my daughter, who is on a ship, studying abroad on a ship, traveling from Brazil to Cape Town, calls me in the mid-Atlantic to my cell phone from her cell phone. Can you explain that one? I was just amazed when I looked at the cell phone. It was her, and I knew she was in the mid-Atlantic. And it was just like talking right across the room here.
Was it her cell phone?
It was her cell phone to my cell phone.
What I suspect is that, and I'm not an engineer, but what I suspect there is either some sort of a bounce off the water. I can be in downtown Chicago, and calls can bounce across Lake Michigan. If you dial 911, it can sometimes skip over to a PSAP that might be in Gary, Indiana, or over in St. Joseph's, Michigan. It's very rare, but that is known that there might be some sort of a skip. And the only other thing I could think of was that the ship had a repeater on the ship that was able to carry the signal over either a satellite back to a base station controller and back to the switch and to your house. But I suspect it's probably something that has to do with a repeater on the ship that allowed that call to be made from a wireless network over a satellite back to the cell network on the ground here in Minnesota.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I know that call is going to cost me dearly, but it was worth it.
Mr. McDermott,
if you're using satellites, that's it. Yes.
Just a minute to the wireless technologies, and maybe elaborate a little bit more on the different choices that the companies made, and because these are different systems, is that correct?
Or right.
Different technologies,
right.
But they speak to each other.
Well, they do, but they don't directly. They do through the switching office, because if you look at the TDMA, which is what AT&T, before they bought Singular, was the original AT&T Mobility, they had launched their network under the time division multiple access, which means that the call was sharing the spectrum in time bursts instead of in a code burst, which is what Verizon Wireless and Sprint have elected to use, a service that was developed by Qualcomm out of San Diego. That code division multiple access allowed us to compress the call and use bursts of code back and forth. So that's why you didn't have any anybody able to listen in on your phone call anymore. The old analog networks were susceptible to people buying a radio scanner from Radio Shack and could listen to your cell phone conversation because they could key in on that frequency. The code division and the time division created these changing codes between the phone and what we call the base station controller at the cell site. Once it hits that cell site and it goes to the wireless, this is something funny because we had talked about how this was so technical and we were going to try to avoid the complex machinations of it. But it's a good question because once it gets to the mobile switching office, it's then basically routed over a landline to a central office of the local exchange provider. So it's then that calls then translated back to if I'm calling a Verizon phone to a AT&T customer on a different platform, that call is translated at the switch, and it's not talking to – the phones aren't talking to each other. They're talking to a base station controller, which is talking to a switch, which is talking to a national operations center, which is talking to the next handoff, maybe a central office or another mobile switching office. So the technology is not direct-to-direct point-to-point connectivity.
So some of these companies, though, have chosen to operate off of the same system, the same technology.
Right, Sprint and Verizon. And a Sprint customer can bring their Sprint phone to Verizon Wireless and activate it on our network. They might not get all of the services that they would have if they operated on a Sprint platform, some certain gaming, maybe internet access would be a little bit different, but for voice telephony, they can use that phone on our network, and we don't lock or block that phone, a Sprint phone, from being activated on a Verizon Wireless system.
And is there a reason why they didn't all choose the same technology?
It was a belief by the engineers of each respective companies that the technology that they'd chosen, because it was brand new, this was brand new technology, that they had a put their money behind what technology they thought would be the most robust and the ability to grow and change and bring new applications to it. Verizon chose the Qualcomm CDMA product. AT&T at that time chose the time division multiple access product. They've abandoned that and have gone to the GSM, which is the global service, a global standard of mobilization, which is the European standard. That standard, the GSM, is an older technology, and Verizon Wireless chose CDMA because it was newer, it had more capabilities, we could do more with it. It was a better platform for us to be able to launch all of the different technological advancements that we have on our network right now, like I was demonstrating with the TV.
Are different advantages to the different technologies.
Right. And I believe, from what I've been told and what I've read, that the fourth generation wireless service will be called long-term evolution. And I believe that the major carriers, if I'm not mistaken, Pat says no? Well, one carrier has chosen another path. But I know several carriers have chosen the long-term evolution, which would allow then them to be equal at that level later on, once that equipment is deployed. Okay. At a cost of billions of dollars. It's very costly. It's very expensive.
You can go on.
Okay. I hope that helped.
It does. The question is that I'm thinking that for the consumer, it would probably be easier if you were all delivering the same technology or using the same technology.
I understand what you're saying, and I think that the best way I can answer that is we compete vigorously for those consumers, and we've created what we think is the best network, the most reliable network, that of all the carriers. I mean, and it's not a commercial. We really have spent $4 to $5 billion a year to upgrade our network, to launch new cell sites, to do capacity relief, and to bring new products and services to the marketplace. That is a technological edge. We think that our CDMA product is better than the GSM, an older, more antiquated product. We think that allows us to market that product as a better service and try to capture that customer on the fact that our network is better, and we believe it.
Okay.
And I think the independent tests also prove that, if you want to look at J.D. Power and the rest of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Now I have to see my counterparts from the other companies after this, so I got to parse my words.
No more commercials.
No, I'll reframe. I think our products will speak for themselves, though, when I show you the TV in a few minutes. The state regulation that Mr. Fuller referenced, I think he looked at my my presentation because I think he's right. The state's attorneys general retain the enforcement of consumer protection laws applicable to all businesses. And they have, in this state, exercised that ability because they have existing laws in Minnesota that afforded the attorney general all the necessary tools that she needed to pursue litigation against one of my competitors. And we believe that process will play itself out in the courts that totally negates the need for any supplemental legislation because she already has the ability to enforce the current consumer protection laws, and she's done so by bringing that action against my competitor. The states regulate 911. They regulate access to people with disabilities. They do consumer education efforts, and also the states regulate number allocation. I didn't put that on there, but they have the right to determine number relief, whether it's going to be a geographic split of an area code or an overlay. Some jurisdictions have decided to go with an overlay versus a split because the split will disenfranchise or inconvenience half of the people in the area code by forcing them to get a new area code. An overlay will allow you to do a new three-digit area code on top of that existing one, like the 651 is overlaid over the 612, so that half the people here would not have to split up their 612 and go to another one. They could just overlay the 651 and have phones. Although that 651, I think, was a result of a split. It wasn't necessary. They could have done an overlay of a 651 over on top of the 612, and that any new phone activated from that point going forward could have been the 651. Instead of doing a geographic split. And the next one, there's some pictures of co-location. The wireless carriers at first, when they were competing, the two in the marketplace up until 1996, 1997, there you would see two towers next to each other, and that often represented the cellular one versus the other provider, the Ameritech or whomever that other mobile provider was. They were competing for the same customer and didn't see any reason to co-locate or help each other build their networks out. And over the years, you would see these what we called tower farms. And then somebody got smart and said, we'd be better off just co-locating on each other's towers because we could build out our networks quicker and we wouldn't be obstructing the landscape with these tower farms. You could have one tower with five or six providers on it and negate the need to have multiple towers in one spot. And the towers are necessary because when our engineers drive around and test our market, they can determine the signal strength at any given point and where they're physically at that time. And we have those commercials with the test man. And I'm not going to go into a commercial, but I'm going to explain that we really have people like that who are test people that drive around in SUVs that are loaded with equipment that test the signal strength not only of our network but of our competitors. And they're able to go find where the dead spots are and then figure out through their RF propagation maps to identify where the best place to put a new cell site would be. And they try to put it in the center of a search ring that allows them to cover as much of a 360-degree circle as possible that would cover that dark spot or that dead spot in the signal strength. And we try to partner with municipalities by using municipal water towers, by using municipal communication structures, municipal buildings. We think that it's proper and appropriate for us to have the equipment at the municipality, paying the money, the rent for these cell sites to the municipalities, and have it be paid for on their network, or paid for it to support the municipal stuff. But there's other examples of existing structures like an apartment building or a hotel, elevator shaft, there's a water tower, a signature in sign. In the raw land site, the standalone monopole is more costly for us to construct and deploy than an existing structure. So it's really not in any of our best interest to build those raw land sites. It's only time you would see a raw land site is if there's no existing structure that is high enough for the signal to carry. It's usually about 125 feet and up to cover the necessary geographic search ring. So, And starting out in 1983 with that call from Soldier Field was made with one cell site on top of the Sears Tower. Then in June of 85, there was about 600 cell sites. And today, as of last June, there is 210,000 cell sites deployed nationally to support 250 million wireless subscribers. One call to Alexander Graham Bell's grandson, and 25 years later, 250 million subscribers in the United States alone used the network that was constructed first in Chicago and then Washington, Baltimore. The 911 calls that we referenced earlier, it's undeniable that wireless service has been a lifesaver. An accident, a crime being committed, somebody's able to use their phone to immediately summons the necessary law enforcement or emergency personnel to help them out. And I think that that's undeniable. I think your PSAP 911 centers will tell you that they're probably getting more calls on wireless than they are on landline. And we pay our share to help subsidize that. Minnesotans pay 65 cents a month to fund the 911. We're mandated by the FCC to have 95% of all of our handsets in use, and I think we've surpassed that now, to have GPS in our network. All of our phones, up to 95% and more, have a GPS chipset in their phone that allows the consumer to be located within a couple of feet instead of trying to have the call taker guess where the caller's calling from, especially if they're not familiar with their surroundings or unable to tell the operator where they're at. We talk about broadband. We're deploying broadband across our network to the four corners of our network as quickly as we can. We've chosen the CDMA. We have a CDMA. We have something called EVDO, which is our broadband product. It's very, very fast, and it allows you to access the internet and download videos, stream videos, do a whole host of very, very interesting things. And it's actually a product that we're deploying that helps rural areas that are underserved by DSL, underserved by broadband, to allow them to have broadband connectivity through the wireless networks that have spent a lot of money to build out in the rural area. I'm going to wrap up in a second here, but I wanted to pass around the so you could see for yourself the interesting aspect of this mobile TV. And I'll have the closing bell from CNBC on, and you could see just really how crystal clear the picture is, that it's real-time live video. The wireless is growing the means of high-speed access at a fast clip. 60% of all ads were mobile wireless subscription as of late. The wireless broadband has now over 18 million subscribers nationally. And again, it goes to the rural penetration. 99.3% of the United States population living in rural counties, or in another way of putting it, 60.6 million people have one or more wireless operator that have the ability to bring broadband to the rural community, and I think that's a strong success story. And the competition's working. There was two carriers in 1985. Now in 2005, you have six or more carriers and supporting a customer base of 250 million people. And then we talked about the innovation. I have the brick phone, my little Juke that's the music player, the MP3 music player, emails, internet browsers. It's just amazing how this industry has really invented itself and reinvented itself over and over again over the 25 years. The other issue I wanted to address quickly before I summarize is we have different types of plans, postpaid plans, which allows the consumer to have a two-year contract to get phones at a subsidized rate that allows them to pay that subsidized rate off over 2 years. We have what we call a declining early termination fee, which means the longer you're committed to stay on our network, the less you'll pay if you decide to leave us and go to a competitor. So the declining early termination fee means that each month that you stay with us, it goes down a certain amount, and at the end, you won't pay the full amount to break your contract with us if for some reason, I don't believe you will, want to leave us to go to a competitor. So we think that that's what the industry wanted, that's what our consumers wanted, and we have made strides to listen to our consumers in that respect. The subsidies nationally, I think this is an unbelievable number, $10 billion a year the industry provides in phone subsidies to make sure that the consumer doesn't have to shell out $300, $400, $500 to get the latest technology. And then on the next page is choices in St. Paul. Each of the carriers that are listed there shows some of the devices that are available to the residents. Prepaid, there's no contracts, no credit checks. It's a grab-and-go type of thing. You just go pull the phone off the shelf, you activate it, and you fill up the minutes like you'd fill up your gas tank. And it doesn't require a contract, and it doesn't. And it's an option that the consumers have if they choose not to enter into a contract with the wireless provider. I also wanted to mention that we have many, many different distribution channels. We have not only our company-owned stores, but we have arrangements with national retailers, with authorized agents. And we try to find as many doors as possible, not only for Verizon Wireless, but our competitors as well, to find the best way to sell their products and get their products in the hands of the consumer in a seamless way that doesn't complicate the buying purchasing process. I think, unfortunately, 833 would actually create a system where that would make that transaction much more complex than it needs to be. Again, the wireless industry is highly competitive, and as a result, we believe firmly that the consumer is benefiting. And I'd be happy to entertain any questions. I know my colleagues, some of them will be speaking later, as well as the president of the Minnesota region for Verizon Wireless is going to, I think, close up our company's remarks later. And then Jerry Keegan, I think, is going to be making some discussion with you on the wireless industry from the National Association standpoint. But I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was trying to decipher this page here, competition works. What could you go over that for me?
Sure.
I'm not following it quite fully.
Here it is. On the bottom you have the year 1985, there's only two providers. And two carriers were the A and B band licensees. 1990, it remained two carriers, and then there might have been a reseller thrown in there. 1995, you start to see that's a good question. Can I get back to you on that? I'm going to find a better answer for this. I wasn't supposed to give this today. A colleague of mine who has taken ill is one that prepared this, and I'd like to circle back with her. Because I understand where she's going with it, but I'm trying to figure out what exactly the bars mean in terms of market. I think as you get far to the right, this represents the 250, 270 million penetration rate, the take rate on the right versus back in 1985 where it was much smaller. Jerry, do you know what it is? How to decipher that? Jerry Keegan from CTIA.
Madam Chair, committee members, it just tries to delineate the number of wireless subscribers and the number of competitors that they have the option of choosing. So, for example, 50 million subscribers have six or more carriers. 95 million subscribers have five or more carriers to choose from. 123 million have four carriers to choose from, et cetera.
Okay, I see that. Does that help?
Yeah, that helps.
My apologies for that.
Okay, any further questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. McDermott.
You're more than welcome. I'll leave these out here until after the hearing if anyone wants to really see what the old technology was like.
Actually, you can remove them.
Oh, okay. Thank you. You're making me take it with, aren't you?
Yes.
Thank you again.
Senator Olson, we're ready for your bill.
Okay.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm very happy to be here on behalf of Senate File 833, which is the Wireless Telephone Consumer Protection Act. Before we get started today, I have a delete all amendment, the A1 amendment, which would put the bill in the form that I'd like to have it presented.
And Senator Anderson, would you like to move
of
that
course,
amendment?
Yes.
Senator Anderson moves the A1 amendment, which is the author's amendment. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam
Senator
Chair.
Olson.
And then also, before I go forward, in terms of what you would prefer, Madam Chair, I also have an A2 amendment, which is presented to me, I have a number of people here from ARP to speak on behalf of this amendment, because it adds to and provides another area of consumer remedy. I'm wondering whether I should move that at this time so that we have the whole, all of the language on the table for discussion.
Senator Olson, you can do that. We're just distributing it, so maybe you can explain it to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What this amendment does is to preserve valuable consumer protections not preempted by federal law. This amendment I've been asked to state to the committee is a priority of ARPS. And what it does is it says that a wireless carrier may not limit by contract the right of a subscriber to bring complaints or the rights and remedies available to a subscriber by law, including class actions in any state or federal court or any agency of competent jurisdiction. A wireless carrier may not, by contract, hold subscribers liable for carriers' legal costs resulting from complaints or otherwise require disputes be settled under contract or contract disputes be settled by submission to arbitration. So it puts in place with respect to how contract disputes are going to be settled certain limitations so that the wireless carrier is not able to require a consumer to give up normal rights that they would have available, normal consumer protection rights under law, in order to have a contract with that carrier.
Okay. Senator Kevin Dahl, would you like to offer that amendment?
Yes, thanks.
Okay. Is there discussion about the amendment? Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would the amendment then, if the customer agreed to an arbitration in a contract, would that nullify that agreement, or would they still be able to choose to do that?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Vandeveer, what the amendment says is that the wireless carrier cannot require the customer to sign an agreement that says the contract would have to be submitted to arbitration. If both parties chose to engage in that or in language or to have that a part of the contract, certainly I don't see anything in the language that would prevent that voluntary choice. But as we do with other types of practices, requiring an arbitration clause is basically shutting the door to the courtroom when a consumer has a complaint, and that would normally be available, a remedy available to that person in law. And so it's not that both parties couldn't agree if they chose to, but they would not be able to require that as a part of the contract.
I'm just wondering if the way
Senator
that reads
Vandeveer.
If, thank you, Madam Chair. If the way that reads, if if that's your intent, it just looks like it could be construed after, if you signed the arbitration agreement, then that you would have the contract would limit you. But I'm not an attorney, so.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Vandeveer, to the extent that there might be any ambiguity there, I certainly would be happy to look at making that language more specific, because I do not believe that the intent would be to say that if there was a voluntary choice on the part of the consumer that wouldn't be later enforceable. I think the intent of this is to say that the consumer cannot be forced into entering into that type of an agreement up front.
This bill will go to Commerce and Judiciary, so I'm sure that they'll give it a good review also. Senator Jungvar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson. I guess I had some of the same concerns having been here working with the realtors many years before I got elected on the transfer disclosure statements and some of the arbitration agreements. By putting this in here, it does seem like it excludes arbitration as opposed to a real estate contract where it's an outlined box where you must discuss the possibility of arbitration and sign whether you would go to arbitration or whether you would reject that in the contract. So I guess if we're going down that road, I would rather see it similar to what goes on in other industries in Minnesota so we're not creating a disparity between industries.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Jungbauer. And I will acknowledge that this language was just given to me. I was aware there was an amendment being drafted, but I do agree that it perhaps needs some I concur with the intent, and my interpretation of it was consistent with what's been what I've explained to the committee. But I believe that even before we get to Commerce and Judiciary, but certainly through that process, we'll want to end up with language that is consistent with what we're doing in other similar situations, as you suggested.
Thank you.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chairman Brettner-Solon. I just want to make sure I understand what you've said, so I'm going to restate what you're saying, and then you can clarify it. What, in essence, this is doing is saying that if I go in and get purchase a service and sign a service contract, there can't be any language in there somewhere in all of those pages of contractual relationship that limits my rights to recourse in the courts. Is that an oversimplification, or is that essentially what you're saying?
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, recourse in the courts or complaints to state or federal agencies. So, for example, we have the Commerce Department and the Attorney General's Office that take consumer complaints. And this would prevent, as a part of the contract language, that would say you're not allowed to bring complaints to appropriate state agencies. Certainly, with respect to arbitration can be, when it's a voluntary choice on the part of both parties, can be a good thing. But in a situation where a person is limited and not allowed to make that choice, that's what this is intended to address.
Further questions or comments? Then let's vote on the amendment. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Olson on the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. First, I would like to acknowledge to those who are here on behalf of the wireless telephone industry, I think a debt of gratitude that we all have to that industry for providing us with a service that I know I rely on every day. I can relate to the big bag phone because as an attorney in rural Minnesota, I was probably one of the first users of that type of technology, and cell phones have certainly made my life easier, communication with my husband and our children, and just in more ways than I can express. So I don't want to convey an attitude that the cell phone industry has somehow not been beneficial to society or that it hasn't provided a service for consumers. The purpose of the Cell Phone Consumer Protection Act, however, is to put in place certain protections with relation to things where we have had a very high number of consumer complaints. Initially, because we did recognize, I think, legislatively in Minnesota and elsewhere that there was a value to promoting this industry, there was really a hands-off attitude in terms of allowing this industry to go forward. And as a result of that, certain practices have developed and that have engendered a lot of consumer concern and complaints. More than 70% of Americans who now use cell phones have likely experienced a problem with their wireless service. I'll give a personal story that I wasn't expecting to have when I introduced this bill. But after session ended, I went back home and was for the first time having a chance to look back on some of my bills, which are automatically deducted, and noticed that I was still being charged for a cell phone that I had I had an older phone that I had had activated for my daughter to use for several months when she worked on my campaign. And I'd made it clear when I had that cell phone activated that I intended to have her use it for 3 or 4 months and that then I would no longer need it. When I called about this, I was passed through one customer service person after another who basically said, well, I'm sorry, ma'am, but if you look on the back page of the language in some buried paragraph, whatever it was, we have your signature on a piece of paper that says that you will pay for that service for the next 2 years. And, you know, I'm an attorney who usually is fairly careful about reading contract language, but lo and behold, apparently they did have my signature on something like that, even though I had clearly said what my intent was at the time I purchased the phone. And they initially tried to tell me, well, you got a deal on the phone, and that's why you had this 2-year extension. And I said, no, I brought in my own phone and had that phone activated. So to make a long story short, I guess no one has to have any sympathy for me, because when I explained that this would be a good story to use when I was presenting the Wireless Telephone Consumer Protection Act, I had the problem rectified. But that is the type of complaint that consumers are bringing forward. What we're asking for here is really very simple. And if I think these are common sense consumer protection standards that are really hard to argue with unless you're somehow intending to do things that don't make good consumer sense to us as we see them. And I have looked at some of the information that talks about how much consumers are going to have to spend more in order to adopt these basic consumer good consumer practices. And I have to say that I would find that, if it's true, very disappointing, because that means we're doing things that on their face are taking advantage of consumers in terms of knowing what they're signing and purchasing. If we're not doing these things, then there shouldn't be a problem putting these protections into law, and we shouldn't be expecting people or any industry to be making money and making profit on the basis of some type of deceptive practices. So in essence, what the Telephone Consumer Protection Act is tailored to do is it requires that consumers receive a copy of their contract so they can look back to see what they've agreed to purchase. This isn't something where things can be, and that has been a problem, where people have not received copies of those contracts. Consumers must be provided an accurate coverage map so they can see where their phone will and won't work. And as we know, this is sometimes complicated. And for people to have this information is really vital in making comparisons and knowing where those extra roaming charges are going to come into play. It will make sure that wireless companies clearly disclose and ensure that the customer understands at the time the contract is signed any provisions allowing the company to charge termination fees or change the terms of the contract. So once again, this can't be somehow buried somewhere on page 4 or perhaps not even situations where the customer isn't even informed, but there has to be a document that the customer signs where this is clearly stated, where these terms are clearly stated. Also, if the customer requests a change in the contract that will cause the wireless carrier to extend the length of the contract, the wireless carrier must notify the customer of the extension and the new contract length. Many times people were making phone calls and just asking for simple changes in the terms of their contract and didn't know that that was reactivating this 2-year commitment. So this is something that requires people to actually be informed of that fact and for there to be documentation they've been told. Customers must provide information to consumers about any charges on the bill that are really being billed for third parties. And so, and there was some discussion about that when this bill was heard last session in the House, and the delete all and amendment was intended to address some of the concerns that the industry had related to that. But basically, again, it's making sure that people know what the billing information is related to. Grants wireless customers protections regarding third-party charges including the requirement that third-party charges be authorized and verified, and giving the customer the right to be reimbursed by the wireless company for any unauthorized and unverified charges for the six-month period before the customer complains about the charges to his or her wireless company. So, again, these are consistent with other types of industries and protections that we give consumers. I believe they're straightforward, and just asking the wireless industry to be somewhat more consumer-oriented than history and the degree of consumer complaints indicate that it has been up to this point in time. I have with me today, Madam Chair, a number of witnesses. First, I'd like to introduce Karen Olson, Deputy Attorney General. Deputy Attorney General Karen Olson, who can, I think, is here not only to answer questions the committee may have regarding the specifics of the bill, but maybe to address somewhat the experience the Attorney General has had with respect to consumer complaints. And I also have with me two consumers, Erlyn Severson and Kristen Farrell.
Okay. Ms. Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I also have present with me Assistant Attorney General Christian Clapp. This bill really is designed to replace the bill that was passed in 2004 and eventually was determined by the courts to be preempted. The bill is providing simple consumer protections. It's simply requiring the cell phone industry to tell the consumer what the contract terms are, to tell the consumer that if they receive a call offering a discount on their bill, that acceptance of such a term will require them to extend their contract for 2 years. It's telling them that if they do decide to terminate their contract earlier, what the fees will be and under what terms. The cell phone industry is the most complained about industry in the nation. The Better Business Bureau ranks it as number one. It is a significant source of complaints for the Attorney General's office. Quite frankly, it is often the most complained about utility-type product at the Attorney General's office receives. And the complaints all are regarding the same thing. People have their contracts extended for 2 years, sometimes locked in, you know, 2 years, and then every time they turn around, they are locked into another two-year contract. This provides two problems for them. One, it doesn't allow the consumer the ability to change cell phone companies because they can't shop around. They can't go to another provider if they don't like the service, if they don't like the product, because they're locked into a termination fee. In some cases, if you're talking a family plan, you have four phones on it, it can be four termination fees. And you take four termination fees at $200 per phone. $800 is a lot to me, and I think it's a lot to the general public. $200 is a lot to many people, I believe. What is happening is people are writing into the office. They're saying that they entered, many of the people know when they originally contract with the company that they're entering into an initial two-year contract, and they recognize that. What they don't recognize is that somewhere along the line, they called to ask a question. They bought a new phone, paid full price for it. They added minutes to their plan. They deducted minutes to their plan. And unbeknownst to them, they've been increased a two-year contract. And this can happen repeatedly. So they can add minutes in January. It extends it 2 years. They can go back in March, April, and say they decreased minutes. Well, then it's extended to 2 years. So you can just see how it goes out perpetually. The industry has indicated that they are solving the problem themselves. The complaints don't show that. The complaints are increasing every year. This is unlike any other industry in that, you know, repeatedly year after year, it is the most complained about industry. The bill is not designed to be onerous on the companies. It's designed to just make them tell the consumer, this is what you're getting. This is, if you enter into this contract, if you make a change in service, if you accept a discount from us, if you buy a new phone, we are going to extend your contract by 2 years. And letting the consumer have meaningful knowledge of that and letting the consumer consent to that, or letting the consumer say, no, I don't want the 5% discount because I don't want to be locked in for 2 years. The consumers don't know this. because you won't see the vast number of complaints that we have and the continuing theme, the continuing story, if they were actually given proper disclosures. So we believe that this bill will address common consumer complaints and provide significant protection, and just giving the arming the consumers with the knowledge and the information that they need to make a decision on their own as to what their contract terms should be with the companies.
Are there any questions of the Deputy Attorney General? Okay, thank you. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You addressed that the industry claims to be addressing the problem. Have you had any feedback or worked with these companies to see if they are actually addressing?
Madam Chair. Deputy Attorney General. Madam Chair, Senator. I was not involved in the bill when it was in the other body last year. However, I do know that there were extensive meetings with the various cell phone companies. I also know I personally have been involved over the last few months meeting with the individual cell phone companies, presenting the language to them, indicating what had been done last year. There were modifications made last year at the request of the cell phone companies, and inviting them to propose language to tell us what has been done. I can tell you that after the Attorney General's office filed a lawsuit against one of the companies is when some of the companies then started saying that they would, you know, not extend contracts or they would change their terms. But it was not until the Attorney General's office actually filed a lawsuit against one of the companies. I'd also like to point out to the committee that several years ago, a number of the companies entered into a voluntary assurance with various attorneys general of the state. Minnesota was not one. A number of the companies, or at least one company, has also entered into a code of conduct with CTIA. Both of these have a number of requirements that would be very similar to the disclosures required in the bill. And this voluntary assurance of discontinuance has been in effect for several years. They have not changed their behavior. It has not worked. Our complaints have not reduced in the last few months. We're still getting the same complaints. We're still hearing the same stories. And, you know, quite frankly, it's disheartening, person after person. You know, military people who are overseas who can't get out of their contract. No.
Thank you
all
for elaborating.
Evidences.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Assistant Attorney General Olson, are there any carriers that don't have a termination fee or, you know, this extension going on? Are they all getting complaints?
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator, my understanding is that all of the companies still have a termination fee. Now, if they happen to have changed that in the last few months, I'm not personally aware of that. I heard Mr. McDermott indicate that there was a prorated fee. I personally have not seen that. And so my understanding is they are still charging the termination fee for their products.
Okay. And, Madam Chair, contract extension, is that the complaints that you're getting on that, is there any carrier that has not been a complaint filed on, or do they all have that program?
Deputy Attorney General or Assistant Attorney General Klatt.
Madam Chair, I believe that all of the companies have at one point or another extended a consumer's contract without their knowledge or consent. Some companies do it more often than others, but all of them are guilty of it.
Thank you.
Would you identify yourself?
That was Christian Klapp, Assistant Attorney General, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, will we have an opportunity to ask other questions to them after we hear the testimony from the industry?
I'm sure they will stay around.
Okay, thank you. Okay.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I heard this, and I read the bill very closely, circled words and stuff. So, I mean, the delete all amendment. So I just wanted to ask either Senator Olson or the Deputy Attorney General, would it be accurate to say that the delete all amendment, the language in the delete all amendment, does not change anything that the cell phone companies, does not require them to change their business practices now. Right? It simply requires them to disclose clearly their business practices, the terms and conditions of the contracts that their customers enter into with them.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, you're really, I think you're correct, Senator Dibble. To the extent that we could, as a state, require them to change their business practices, I would be bringing a bill to you today that would say that you can't have an exclusive phone that we say is worth $250 that I might be able to go buy somewhere else for $75 and then use that to make me sign a two-year contract because you have a monopoly on how you've set up that phone to be used. And there are a lot of other things that I would be doing and presenting to this committee if we had not been told or we understand that that's been preempted by federal law. I know that there are efforts at the federal level. Senator Klobuchar is bringing a bill forward that will address some of these issues. But you're correct. We're really not going very far with this because we're just simply asking that consumers know what they're getting into because that's all we feel we can do that isn't going to be preempted by federal law.
Senator Dibble. Well,
Madam Chair, I only asked the question because, frankly, I don't recall the language of the previous bill, but I think it was very similar to this because I've received a number of emails and phone calls prompted by the cell phone companies from my constituents that tell me that we're shutting down their ability to do meaningful business in Minnesota and shutting down their ability to generate the kind of profits that they need to generate in Minnesota in order to provide all the lovely innovations and et cetera. And I don't see anything in this bill that shuts down cell phone business in Minnesota. I see simply a clear reading of the terms and conditions that customers are entering into when they're signing up for cell phone service.
Okay. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to thank Senator Dibble for, I think, making a very valuable point that really is all this bill is doing.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson. I guess I was getting a little concerned when I read on line 1.29, disclose a good faith estimate. Since that only occurs typically in a home mortgage, I'm starting to think the cell phone industry is getting somewhat akin to a home mortgage. Maybe with good reason, but having said that, I'm really trying to understand the third-party goods and services. Could you explain that to me a little more?
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator, the third party is really an issue of whether or not someone has the right or whether or not the consumer actually accepted a third party's product or whether they're billing them inappropriately. There are a lot of complaints that there are charges appearing on the bill for third-party products, say a ringtone, that was never consented or agreed to. And what we're asking is that either the carrier, the cell phone provider, or the third party, and, you know, quite frankly, the third party person who's billing should be able to provide this, is provide authorization that, in fact, the consumer consented to that charge.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm getting confused if it's assistant or deputy attorney general.
Deputy.
Okay. Having just gone through a 16-year-old with a cell phone and trying to understand all this, so the third-party billing then would be ringtones, downloadable games, some of the other data-type things off the internet web browser type things, because I think that on bills that is probably one of the hardest things to understand as technology increases. But quite honestly, the way you've got it written here, I find this almost harder to understand than a cell phone bill. So I'm struggling with what it all means, I guess.
Deputy Attorney General, is there any clarification you can add to that?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think what this is trying to make sure is that the consumer at the end of the day knows what they're going to pay for. So when they sign up for the service and say it's $29.95 per month, but there's an additional $10 in its fees, that the consumer actually realized that it's $39.95 because for most of us, we have to budget. We don't have unlimited funds, and so we want to make sure that we're paying for what we think we can afford. And the same with the third-party goods and services, to make sure that, you know, you're not clicking on something and just thinking, you know, you're responding to a survey, and then all of a sudden you're getting a ringtone that you're billed for every month, and there was never any disclosure by the third party that there was going to be a bill or that you were accepting any service. And so really it's just allowing the consumer the benefit, if there is this third-party billing, that they have the right to dispute it, and then someone needs to demonstrate that there was consent to this.
Senator Jungbar.
Madam Chair, and again, I'm kind of thinking out loud because I don't really understand this, and I agree with the bill in terms of how what we're trying to do. I'm not sure this is the way to get at it, because in terms of a statute, I mean, even if a consumer starts looking at this kind of thing, I don't quite honestly think they're going to have any idea what you're trying to get to here. Within statute, is there any ability to clarify types of third-party billings? Do you understand what I'm...
Might I try?
If you can, that would be great, Madam Chair.
On your credit card, sometimes you'll get some billings that you don't understand or you dispute. You call your credit card company and you say, you know, I didn't really authorize this, and then they check into it for you. And I believe that this is providing the same thing, or otherwise providing a telephone number where you can contact that party.
Madam Chair, and I understand that
kind
of thing.
I may be wrong. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And landlines also, the term third-party billing appears to have a meaning within the industry, whether it's landlines or cell phones. The consumers are probably not going to be reading this legislation. It's going to be more important that they can read their bill. But if there is confusion among members in terms of what we're passing or what this refers to, then perhaps we need to give, for example, you know, some examples of what we're talking about. Again, using a personal experience, I've changed my cell phone a lot because my need for services has evolved, and I've moved. And one of the things that I was supposed to get free was a free 800 number. And I noticed that that sometimes comes on and off my bill, and every time it comes on again, I call, and it goes off again because it's supposed to be off. But I think what we're trying to do is, with respect to, there are a couple of different categories here. One is the category of things that cell phone companies are offering and charging for and profiting from, and making sure that those things are specifically delineated and that they have something showing that the customer has agreed to pay for each of those things, and that the customer understands that those things are billed separately by the cell phone company, that they're not a tax or a surcharge. They're something the customer has a choice over. And then the other category of things are things that third parties are adding to your bill, because you've maybe gone online and you've clicked on a ringtone or something, that a 900 number or something that is coming from somewhere else and being automatically added to your bill. We're saying that there has to be some evidence that you authorized that charge.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson. And I'm understanding it now, but I guess I'm not feeling like the bill gets to helping the consumer that way. And I can use a great example again with my 16-year-old's phone. And, you know, I guess I'll mention the name of the company because they're probably the only ones that have the system, VCast. I got my daughter a new phone with supposedly a 30-day free trial to VCast, and we got all the paperwork that told us it was a 30-day trial. Problem is, it didn't show up on the contract. So I'm checking the bill online to make sure that I'm not going to have any surprises, and I see like a $76 and some cent megabyte charge or something for going online, and I had no idea what a megabyte charge was, and the contract didn't really talk about all these independent charges. But we'll just say that by the time I got done with the phone company, it was a three-hour conversation and a lot of time online trying to understand the billing. But it seems like this offers the consumer a remedy but doesn't get to the explanation up front. So somebody, I think that's the hardest part in the contract, is understanding what these third-party charges are, and I understand them now. But how does that help the customer when they're going to get the phone? This helps them with a remedy later on if they didn't understand it. Does that make more sense? Am I clarifying myself now that I think the customer needs the help up front in understanding all the potential third-party charges?
Does this bill address that? Senator Olson?
Yes, Madam Chair, I believe it does address that, because it's stating that this must be included, and maybe I'll let the Attorney General's office speak to this, but my understanding is that this is going to have to be included in the contract as well as on the bill. And I'd also maybe point Senate counsel, if this is helpful, to Section 273.665, which is similar language dealing with landlines that this language was modeled after. So I guess to the extent that Senator Jungbauer's concern is that we make sure that the language is easily readable by consumers and that they're understanding what all of these things mean, if this doesn't go far enough, I think that we can work with the language to make it even more meaningful to consumers in the area that you're discussing.
Okay. Senator Dibble, just on this issue, because there are three other people wanting to speak.
Yeah, just what I think I'm hearing Senator Jungbauer say is that what I think this bill does is it assumes that the third-party line item is specifically enumerated on the bill. And I think Senator Jungbauer thinks that perhaps sometimes those third-party charges are not specifically spelled out clearly on bills. And this legislation assumes that, and perhaps Senator Jungbauer's concern is that maybe sometimes those don't appear as clearly as they should on bills, and maybe that's somewhere where we can do some work.
When I'm hearing him say he wants to know up front that he's going to get it on his bill.
Exactly.
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Jungbauer and Senator Dibble, maybe we need to add language to the bill that would say something like, you know, that these things are identified in language clearly, which clearly represents their purpose, or the, you know, simple language that's understandable to consumers. We have other statutes that talk about avoiding legalese and making things that clearly understandable, so maybe we can borrow from some of that language and incorporate that into this bill if you think that would be helpful.
Well, let's see if we can work on that, and we can move on.
Madam Chair, I was just going to mention the previous subdivision.
Senator Dibble.
About government taxes and fees is in that same spirit. So,
mm-hmm. Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Chair. My question is there anything in the language that we're talking now about what it is that needs to be clearly articulated so that a person knows the contract that they're entering in? And that we're also talking about the fact that there have been some things being done to try to, especially as it relates to extension of service contracts under certain conditions, that there's a termination fee if you terminate your contract early, and then some maybe later initiation of an effort to prorate what those would be in order to accommodate a free phone or something like that, or some upfront costs. Is there anything in the language of this bill or contract language that defines the terms of the conditions under which the consumer can terminate the contract without penalty, even though that may have been a part of the contract? So, claiming, for example, that the service that was provided was not provided or was not provided adequately, or that the service was interrupted too frequently. I heard testimony saying that doesn't happen anymore, but I'm not sure we'd all agree with that. And so my curiosity is about whether or not there's language that as a customer I have terms or conditions in that contract that define when I can terminate that contract without penalty.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, there isn't language in the bill that addresses that specifically. I guess I would ask the Attorney General's office to maybe address whether they feel that area is preempted by federal law, if that's something we could address in this bill, because what we couldn't do are some of the things that I personally would have liked to have done, which is like go directly to the question of whether we can have these two-year contracts. So I'll let them address that. But I would also say that to the extent it isn't preempted by federal law, we do have general law that says when one party is not complying with the terms of a contract, that is a reason for the other party to be able to terminate the contract. And so, so it's possible just under law that we already have that there may be that legal remedy if it isn't something that's preempted by federal law. And I guess I'd ask the Attorney General
if I can afford to litigate.
Right, I know. but perhaps to the extent it isn't preempted by federal law, we could even add to this something that would specifically state, as we do in other contracts where we have consumer protection language that says under these certain circumstances you have a right to terminate your contract.
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator, you're correct that it doesn't overall have any provision in under what terms they can terminate their contract if they're actually in a two-year contract. Subdivision 5, which talks about the contract extensions, does say that failure of the provider to make any of the disclosures or obtain any of the consents required in this subdivision voids any contract extension covered by this subdivision. So as respects the contract extensions, if they did not provide the disclosure, if they do not have evidence that the consumer actually consented, then there is no contract extension. It would revert back to what the original contract extension was, and they could then terminate their contract.
Okay. Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Olson or others. One of the things that has come up is this bill has come up, and we get visits and so on and so forth. But I think they're legitimate questions. What do we do about, the grab-and-go phones? What do we do about the online purchases? What do we do about corporations who may distribute or at least give the opportunity for employees to get phones through an employee discount program and maybe issue them within their company, the retailers, Radio Shack, Target, others that will be doing that. Does your bill allow that kind of thing to happen with some level of ease, or are we putting on these kind of situations some real undue burden?
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator. No, I think what you previously heard the cell phone industry testify, in fact, is their creativity, their technological advances. For example, on the Internet, it'd be very simple. All you're asking, if the consumer goes online and they are accepting an offer, that there's full disclosure there and the consumer has the full disclosure in front of them and they consent. So I read the terms. I'm accepting a two-year contract. I realize there's a two-year contract termination fee. I accept and agree to that offer. Similarly, if they're going into a Target store, many of us go into Target right now. If you've ever bought a TV, there's often extended warranties offered. The people at Best Buy have the capability to explain an extended warranty. Similar, what they would have to do is they'd have to provide coverage maps. I don't think it's unreasonable. I don't think it's a burden for any distributor of a cell phone to provide the contract terms. And I think it'd be horrible to say that it's burdensome to tell the consumer the truth, to tell the consumer what they're going to get. Furthermore, for the large companies, you decide who is the customer. So if it's one of our large Minnesota companies, they would be contracting with their purchasing agents. They would disclose the terms to their purchasing agent. And this is a simple issue of letting the consumers, letting whoever your customer is, know this is the agreement that you're bargaining for. And this is my end of the contract. This is your end of the contract. Do you agree?
Madam Chair. Okay. Senator Koch.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Olson, I wanted to get back to the third-party claims as well, and I'm all too familiar with this. I have an 11-year-old, and she saw an ad on TV, and one short text message later, and I had a charge on my phone bill, called the phone company. They it was clearly, I would have to say, Senator Jungbauer, it was clearly a third-party charge. That was very delineated on my phone bill. And after talking with her and realizing, oh, but it was just so quick, you know, the charge was the charge, and frankly, my daughter paid mom back, and we've not had any problem with that since. So I understand what it is. My concern is asking the wireless carrier to deal with, you know, a lot of this is talking about disclosure issues and contract issues with the wireless carrier. This is asking for the wireless carrier to sort of do the police work on a third party. On a third-party charge, and I have some concerns about that. And here I'm wondering, you know, Senator Dibble's point was that these are a lot of things that we're not asked that they're already doing. We're not really asking them to change any of their business practices. It seems to me that this subdivision asked them to do some changes in their business practices. This is more about disclosure. This is more about business practices. So I'm just wondering if you could address some of those concerns or tell me where I'm off base on that.
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator. From what I understand is there, a few years ago, the problem with the third-party billing was even more of a problem. There were many companies that, from what I understand, maybe were not as reputable who were providing lots of charges. I see this as an issue of the cell phone carrier. They are the ones who decide what companies are allowed to bill on their phone contracts. And so this would essentially what would require them to do is to deal with reputable companies, to deal with companies, Ringtone USA, I'm making that name up, but to deal with a company that's giving forthright disclosure to the consumer. So we're not asking them to change their practices. We're just asking them to make sure that the companies that they're allowing to bill on their bills, that those companies be reputable enough to at least tell the consumer that when you accept this, and your daughter accepts this offer, that there's going to be a charge every month. And my guess is that, you know, if I was a company and there were numerous companies that seemed to have an overabundance of problems of consumers claiming that they didn't agree to that charge, that I would no longer have that company work with me. And so it's simply a matter of making sure that in the end, if you're going to put a charge, a third-party charge on the cell phone bill, that third party be able to prove that, in fact, it's a charge that was agreed to by the consumer.
Okay. Madam Chair? And Mr. Fuller is telling me that this is language we adopted for landlines in 2004?
Oh, Madam Chairman, in 1994 we passed the fraudulent telephone services billing law, which was these 1-800, 1-900 numbers and their disclosures, and minors weren't liable, and you could dispute the bill, and you only had to pay part of the bill, and it had to be separately stated on the bill, the charges. So I think Deputy Attorney General mentioned it. We did it, but it was 1994, a long time ago. A lot of the similar type of policing of similar activities.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps Mr. Fuller or maybe the Deputy Attorney General can explain or tell me what is the penalty that's referred to in Subdivision 6. What are the penalties for the wireless carriers if they do not follow that section? Or are there different levels of penalties, and what's the amount? If you could
Deputy
please tell
Attorney
me.
General.
Well, 8.31 allows for civil penalties for each and every violation, and injunctive relief. And the Attorney General's office, of course, can also seek restitution for violations. And under 8.31 also there is an individual right to proceed in a case under the Attorney General statute.
Madam Chair, is there a dollar amount to those penalties?
There is, Madam
Deputy
Chair.
Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, yes, there is a dollar amount. I believe it's $2,500.
$2,500.
I'd have to double check the statute.
I'm having a temporary memory block.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you. I think Mr. Fuller just said it was $25,000 for that penalty, which is $25,000 for those penalties. That's a very hefty penalty. Madam Chair, from me.
Senator Rosen.
My other question, too, there seems to be a disconnect, Deputy Attorney General, on this communication or the working relationship that you've had with the carriers and what has led up to this point of this bill by Senator Olson. So if you could give me further how the meetings, you know, which companies you've met with, and why we're at this point. To me, it seems like what I've heard from the industry and what I'm hearing now, they're not meshing at all. And I do think that this is something that could have been taken care of with some communication and some collaboration. So if you could please give me a historical.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rosen, and I can only say that I only heard from the industry on this bill, even though I introduced it last week. And some of the concerns that were expressed to me were hard for me to understand because I think they were things that were easily overcome. As the Deputy Attorney General said, concerns about, you know, shutting down business and not being able to do things over the Internet. Well, we have lots of companies that contract over the Internet, and we have steps we know we go through so that they can make those contracts enforceable. And so it really isn't an overwhelming problem. I did invite the industry to provide me with language if there was anything specific that they thought would make this a better bill from their perspective, and I have not received any suggested language from the industry.
And Senator Rosen, my staff also met with them, asked for the similar information, and did not receive any in return.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I'm just wondering, and I'm just throwing this thought out, that perhaps this is an ongoing process, that perhaps this is something that can be negotiated out. But I still do have questions for the Deputy Attorney General as far as the meetings, the level of negotiation that has occurred with the industry.
Sure. Deputy Attorney General.
Madam Chair, Senator. As I mentioned, I wasn't part of the cell phone legislation last year, but I understand that was in the other body, that there were numerous meetings and there were numerous changes made to the bill that eventually went through the other body as a result of negotiations. I can tell you that several months ago, our office met with T-Mobile, Verizon, AT&T, and Altel. They came into our office. We provided the file from last year. We indicated that we intended to propose legislation again this year. It would be similar vein to last year's legislation. And we asked for any comments. We have received no suggested language back. The response has been that they don't want to be regulated, that they don't want any language. They don't want anything in the statute. So, you know, yes, we're at an impasse from that standpoint because the office believes, based on the consumer's complaints, to the Better Business Bureau, that there is a need for regulation. The industry is not regulating itself. We have approached them. We asked them for input. We asked them what language wasn't workable. And when the response is that there's no language that's workable, there's really nothing more we could do.
Senator Anderson.
Are you done? Yeah, okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to ask about the third-party charge section in relationship to a constituent complaint that I had, which was someone who's a young child, you know, like a teenager, young teenager had a cell phone and lost it. And apparently, I mean, they thought it was lost. It ended up being stolen or found by somebody who made hundreds of dollars worth of calls on it. But in the meantime, they called their company and told them it was lost and tried to cancel the service or whatever, get a new phone or whatever it was. I don't remember the details. But essentially the question was whether there would be some way to not have to pay for all those unauthorized charges that somebody else racked up on this phone after they'd reported it to be, you know, no longer in their possession. You know, the phone was gone. And so, and the company wouldn't do that. And we all know, I think, with credit cards, they're really, we have a federal law that requires credit cards. I think you were talking about that earlier when I was outside of the room for a minute. I was listening. You know, that requires a disputed charge to be held up by the credit card company, and they try to see if there's recourse and see if it's, you know, a legitimate charge or not. And that's what my constituent was asking for, if we could have some kind of protection like that for that type of situation. And I do have another bill that I've drafted that would specifically deal with that, but I'm wondering if this would this would maybe get at that problem as well, because that would really be a third-party charge that hasn't been expressly authorized.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Anderson, I wish I could say yes, but I don't think that is the case with this bill. I think that third parties refer to parties that have made arrangements with the cell phone company to have their charges added to the bill. And I'm not sure whether, again, I don't want to offer a legal opinion with respect to your bill, but when it comes to directly regulating that contract and charges between the cell phone industry and the consumer, I don't know how far we can go down that direction without running into third-party preemption. Because, again, we're not telling them how to do their billing as much as just making people aware of what they're being charged for, and we know we can do that.
Okay. We do have a number of people that want to testify, or at least we have a couple of people. There are others that wish to testify also, but it will depend on how much time we have.
Do we have time, Madam Chair, to hear from the consumers who are here to testify that are on the list?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Madam Chair, may I introduce the consumers?
You may.
Madam Chair, Senators, we have Erlene Severson and Kristen Farrell who are here today to testify.
Okay. Welcome. Come up to the table. And whoever would like to speak first, if you would just introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senators, I am Erlene Severson. I was a Sprint customer for approximately 8 years. Within that period, I knowingly changed my contract 3 times when I added phones or added minutes. The last time resulted in a contract ending January 3rd of 08. Late last year, while speaking to Sprint, I discovered that there were 2 additional contracts added to my account, one ending February 9th and another ending August 9th. As it turned out, I'm the owner of the contract. I was in Africa in August of last year. My daughter had lost her cell phone, transferred her number, called in, my adult daughter, called in to transfer her number to an unactivated phone she had in her possession. At that time, she was offered, not the owner of the contract, but offered a $100 credit on our next bill if she upped for another 2 years. She declined. I didn't find this out until I made this phone call. My daughter explained that to me. I thought that adding those 2 contracts without my consent or knowledge was really audacity. After disputing this to some length, I was told not to worry, that if I left Sprint within the 2-year period, I would not be charged the early termination fee. We had 4 phones. My response that this was not good enough, I wanted those dates wiped out of my account. She said it was not possible and repeated again, you won't be charged an early termination fee. Early in January, I closed my Sprint account and transferred my personal number to another cell phone company. I was told at that time I would not receive another bill. This seemed reasonable to me, as I had expected credits for paying the first month ahead when I added each phone. We did receive another bill. Their explanation did not make any sense according to my past bills that I had in my possession. This month, I received a bill for a $200 early termination fee on my personal phone, the number which I had transferred to another company. After 2 long phone calls, this amount was credited to my account. I try to be honest and fair in my transactions. I expect the same of the companies that I deal with. I believe that Sprint is neither honest nor fair with its customers, but has attempted to increase revenue by deceptive practices. These and other problems I've had with Sprint have resulted in great frustration, many long phone calls, and often resulting with little satisfaction. I believe that Sprint is aware of the fact that many people will not follow through on disputes, possibly due to the lack of time or stamina, or simply not caring to be troubled. I am sorry to say that eventually I have fallen into that category. As we paid the final bill without further explanation, just to be rid of dealing with Sprint. Thank you.
Are there any questions or comments? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And then Kristen Farrell.
Madam Chairman, Senators, I've been a Sprint cell phone customer since 2001. And I've always known that dealing with them is really difficult, but generally didn't have big problems with them. Starting in fall of 2006, I started to not get voicemail messages that were left on my phone. They just were not there. This presented a lot of trouble for me personally, but also as I was in grad school, it was academically rough to not get messages. I went to a store, the Sprint store. They told me that I needed to talk to someone on the phone, that they couldn't help me. I talked to someone on the phone. They sent me back to the store. Eventually, they fixed the problem. In spring of 2007, again, this same thing started to occur with the voicemail. And I eventually called them. And after about probably speaking to 10 different service representatives, dropped phone calls, people hanging up on me, I ended up being routed to a store where then I talked to them on the phone. And what they told me was, your phone is faulty, and so you need a new phone. But if we give you a new phone, you will be then on another 2-year contract. And I said, you're not fulfilling the terms of my contract as it is. Well, voicemail is not guaranteed to you under our contract. The phone working is guaranteed to you, but voicemail is not. So we are fulfilling our contract. To which I said, I'm not going to sign up for another 2-year agreement because right now I don't want service from you, period. So we went back and forth, and finally I spoke to a woman, now probably my 15th customer service representative and probably about 15 hours in, who said that she assured me that she would send me a new phone and that they would not re-up me for 2 years. And I said, is that guaranteed? Yes, it's guaranteed. I took her name down, her first name, because that's all they give you. I took her customer service number down. Everything was all set. Well, about 3 weeks later, after getting my new phone in the mail and using it, I get a bill that shows that I have signed up for another 2-year contract. And I again call, and they say that if I accepted the phone in the mail that they sent me, that I am required to have another 2-year contract, and that they never give out new phones without requiring you to have a new 2-year contract. And so my choices were to either send them back the phone and just not have a phone for my for the rest of my contract with them, or that I could re-up for 2 years. At no time was I asked specifically if I wanted a new 2-year contract. At no time did I sign anything. I did not verbally agree to anything. And at that point, I felt like there was nothing I could do. They continued to bill me every month regardless. And so at that point, I reported my experience to the Better Business Bureau. After hearing from the Better Business Bureau, Sprint contacted me and left a message on my home phone saying that they wanted to talk to me. I called the number back that they left for me and called back probably 10 times, different days, left the same message for the same woman. Meanwhile, the Better Business Bureau contacted me, and Sprint had reported to them that I was not willing to work with them and that Sprint had not been able to get a hold of me and that I was not returning their phone calls. Eventually, I did call enough times that the woman finally was there one time, and we solved it. She did not require me to sign up for another two-year agreement. My argument is just that I spent probably so many hours I can't even explain. I'm a highly educated person. I feel like not everyone has the time or the education to follow up with Sprint and know that they were doing something wrong, and that there was no way for me other than through the Better Business Bureau to have any sort of leverage against this company because they could continue to bill me regardless.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you, both of you, for your testimony. And now I'd like to call on former Attorney General Skip Humphrey, who is the state president of AARP.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome.
Members of the committee. On behalf of our members, some of whom are here, on behalf of all of those people who have just testified, frankly, we ought to try and keep this Humphrey comment very short because I think you've heard the reason why this legislation is needed. Just one sad story that I need to give you just personally. The bad news is that at least I feel comfort in the fact that so many other people have had the same problems I've had. But the reality is, at one point, I had a friend who had exactly some of the problems that were being mentioned here, and I finally said, look, there's one quick way to cut this off. Next time you have a person that doesn't respond, you just say, that's fine, thank you, please give me your name. I am reporting this to the Attorney General's office, and I want you to know I heard back from that person, and they said, gee, they took care of it. That's an unfortunate way to deal with relationships, and it's very important that this committee and other committees come to grips with the reality of trying to find some balance between those who provide good services. I mean, we all have a love-hate relationship with our cell phone. I need it. I use it. And when it works, it's fantastic. When it doesn't, it's worse than a car that doesn't work. But there needs to be balance, and there needs to be balance in the ability for both sides in the contract to really come to grips with this. This is even more important when it comes to members of AARP and those in that age group. I'm here representing the 700,000-plus members of AARP, more than 39 million members around the country. And when it comes to seniors, quite frequently the reason that seniors have those phones are for two things. First of all, security and safety. And they need to be able to know that they have those services and primarily use it for those kinds of purposes. They're not getting all the data. They're not bringing all that other information in and all the rest. But they need to have the ability to know that they are going to have good service when they need it and where they need it. That's what's most important to them. The other thing that was pointed out in the testimony, the very telling testimony that I heard here today, and I wanted to reemphasize, is that according to a recent AARP Public Policy Institute report, more complaints have been reported to the Federal Communications Commission about cell phones than any other business in the United States in recent years. So we're not alone in these kinds of concerns. What we're looking for is to have adequate information so that we know what we're getting into and how to respond to the problems when those problems arise. And in any contract relationship, there's going to be problems. It's a matter of how do you resolve those problems in an amicable way that allows the service to go forward and the contract to be fulfilled. So I'm not going to give you the other stories. There are many, many stories that that could be told here of the problems of service. But, you know, these stories do illustrate that consumers around the state are becoming more and more frustrated with the ambiguity surrounding cell phone contracts and coverage. AARP believes that these consumers deserve clear, reliable information that is easily understood and comparable among different providers, so that you have some basis of understanding where it's going. The other day, I had to talk to my provider. There were some charges on there, $75 charge for something I'd never seen before. Well, we worked it out. We worked it out. But, you know, the fact is, I then asked her, I said, how long is my contract in place? And I was told, and it was like heaven, I heard, June, you're out of it. Why should a consumer feel like, you know, I'm finally getting released from prison? I should be that company should be soliciting me and saying, do you like the service? Are we helpful to you? Can we respond to your needs? Because we want you back. And I'll tell you, they're going to have to go a long ways to get me back. I'm going to go on that month-to-month deal, and hopefully no one, not my kids or anybody else that's on that contract, are going to do something to lock me in for another 2 years. So we'll just see where it goes. There is that amendment, and I would like, I understand from the author, and Senator Olson, I deeply appreciate the work that you're doing on this. I believe that you are correct in saying that we want to be able to have the opportunity. We don't mind the idea of arbitration, but it shouldn't be binding mandatory where you're locked into it and probably in the mouse print in the middle of a 10-page contract somewhere. It needs to be open, needs to be fully disclosed. People need to understand what they're getting into on the front end of all of these things. I'll leave it at that.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments? Thank you for your testimony. Oh, Senator
Madam Chair, I just wanted to comment that I don't think they're 10-page contracts anymore. They're now on a cash register receipt about 20 feet long.
You are great. And the report, the service contract, Madam Chair, it keeps changing every month. They're, quote, improving it. And I keep trying to figure out, well, what did it mean last month when it was this version, and it's this version this month?
And Madam Chair, to further that, you know, with these, thank you, Madam Chair, to further that, you know, I'm kind of trying to figure this out with the AARP. I don't know. Is this a data privacy thing that somehow they got my name and knew what age I just turned and asked for membership? And these contracts, just, I think I need a new bifocal prescription for those new contracts, too, at the same
time. Remember, you're talking to a psychologist. That sounds like paranoia.
Madam Chair, though, you do raise, Senator, you do raise a very important point. Many times people who are a little older have a hard time reading. If you have a hard time reading it, try it when you're 80. So these are necessary services. We're in the digital age. There's going to be more rather than less of all of this. And so we need to make sure that people understand what they're getting into and how they can remedy the problems so that contracts are about partnerships. They're about people that want to do business together. It shouldn't be kind of this forced relationship, a locked-in relationship. And so whatever can be done at the state, and certainly there's a relationship here with the Federal Communications Commission and preemption and all that, but whatever the state can do, particularly to help the consumer, to help the older consumer in particular, I would ask the committee's indulgence in doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, the next speaker is Juanita Brown. Ms. Brown.
Good afternoon, or I guess maybe I should even say good evening at this point, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to appear before you here today. My name is Juanita Brown. I am the Regional Vice President for Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for AT&T, and I am responsible for AT&T's business here in the state of Minnesota. I thought I would start out just real briefly telling you who AT&T is today, because we have kind of changed over the last few years. And basically today in the state of Minnesota, AT&T provides wireline local exchange services. We provide broadband services. We provide long-distance services as well as wireless services. In the state of Minnesota, we employ over 2,200 individuals, many of those whom are union employees. And in the past 3 years, AT&T has invested over $150 million here in the state of Minnesota. And primarily, we've done that to upgrade the infrastructure for our wireless facilities here. So we have employees here, we're investing here, and we're very happy to be part of Minnesota. Now I'm going to turn my attention to what's before us today on the cell phone bill. And, you know, I'm not going to do an infomercial like Mike did for his company, but I did bring a couple props here that I'd like to use as maybe we go through the process. Because, you know, our understanding of what the purpose of this bill is very similar to what you heard the Attorney General and Senator Olson explain. We believe that this bill was an attempt to define what information should be provided to a consumer at the point of sale when they purchase wireless service. Then, in addition, we thought the bill was trying to explain, you know, what should the process be when consumers purchase a good or service that is in addition to their wireless service, and it is billed on their wireless bill, the third-party billing that we've been talking about here today. So in essence, as we looked at this bill, it's about contracts, what should be disclosed, if they're extended, what those processes should be, early termination fees. You know, when we talk about early termination fees, you know, we've heard that discussed, and how should customers be treated with those? The purpose behind an early termination fee, I guess, and one of the things that's come clear to me is all wireless equipment, whether it's this Go phone, whether it's the cell phone that you that Mike had up here earlier, every single one of them require a contract. Now, some of those are month-to-month contracts. Some of those are term contracts. 12-month contracts, 24-month contracts. Even this GoPhone, which is a prepaid service, which you pay in advance for, requires a contract. And I'm going to cover that just a little while later in my discussion with you. But I think it's important to understand when we talked about this bill, and believe me, we spent a lot of time last year, AT&T, as well as the entire industry, meeting with the Attorney General, with their staff, with the House author, in an attempt to clarify how the bill should be drafted so it was appropriate for the wireless industry. Because as I think John Fuller indicated to us, what this really did is they used the model for landline phones. And unfortunately, a phone is not a phone is a phone. As you heard Mike talk earlier today, the technology that is used for wireless services is very different than what we've always known as a traditional phone. They don't work the same. They cannot be expected to perform the same. And so what we ended up doing last year is trying to work our way through the issue with the Attorney General. We were very upfront that we as an industry do not believe legislation is necessary. We still do not believe legislation is necessary, but if legislation was going to be passed, what we did last year was say, then let us at least work with you, and we appreciate the time that we were given in order to minimize the concerns that we had with the bill. Because if you look at the bill as it was introduced to the point where it left the House, it changed dramatically. We still had concerns, though, concerns that we were optimistic that we could bring to the Senate and have addressed here because they were the remaining issues. But, you know, I'm going to divert my talk for just a minute to answer at this point. Senator Dibble asked the question, will the bill, as it's been amended today, impact our industry? Will it require us to do changes? And I think the Attorney General said no. And in some part, that's very true, because everything that's in this bill we do. Do we do it in the prescriptive manner that is prescribed by this bill? No, we do not. Our contracts and our terms of service, which are what is required in this bill to be given to customers. I'll just give you a quick example. This bill requires them to be in 12-point font. When I sat down last year with the Attorney General staff and with the bill author and said, here's our terms of service, is this sufficient? And they responded, oh, yes. Then I went back and asked my folks, what font is this? Well, the bill required 12-point. My contract was 10-point. So I would have to reissue every contract, and we have a terms of service pamphlet that we give as part of our contract that is in large print, which I loaned to Senator Anderson in one of her questions during this debate. It's right there. She's holding it up.
I can read that without my glasses.
But it's 10-point font. And so will it cause us to change our processes? Yes, it will.
That wasn't my question.
Senator Dibble.
I have no doubt the cell phone company will have to do some things. But my question was essentially changing business practices. That's my question.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood because I was going at it.
And Ms. Brown, I don't think you have to reissue the contracts to everybody because it's in the wrong font. I think it's just going forward that you have to issue that.
And that's exactly, Madam Chair, how we understood the bill, that it would be just going forward. But we use the same contract in Minnesota that we used in every other state in the country. So we mass produce them, and so what it would cause is an additional expense to the company in order to be able to have the 12-point font contract here in Minnesota. That's the change in process that we as a company would have to have in our systems. And that was the point I was trying to point out. We came very close last year as the session ended in coming, like I said, we closed the gap between us and the Attorney General. But, you know, what happened over this late summer and early fall is as we entered those meetings again with the Attorney General, we then took the bill back out, and, when we weren't in the middle of deadlines during the legislative session, we took a hard look at this bill. And what we found is that there are distribution channels that we have, there are phones that we have that would be impacted, and I believe that they were not intended to be impacted by the language in this bill, but they certainly will be impacted. We also noticed that the industry itself had made many changes, had announced policy changes. We've talked about them today, and I actually have copies of AT&T's news release and Sprint's news release where we actually announced in October that we were changing our practices as far as when a customer's contract could be extended. For AT&T, because I know it specifically, the only time we extend a customer's contract is if that customer purchases a new phone and it's discounted, okay? If you call in and say, I have plan A and I want to change to plan B, contracts have never been extended from our company, okay? And they will not be extended. So the problems that have been talked about there, we believe, have been addressed by the industry because all of the major carriers, in fact, Alltel was the first. Back in 2005, they had a marketing slogan that they would not change their contracts if you called in and modified your plans. Well, as you've been told, the industry is hyper-competitive, and so we all strive to get our customers to come to us. And as a result, what you see is you will see us following one another. And on the contract issue, Verizon and AT&T announced their change in October. Then you had T-Mobile and Sprint come in behind them in November of last year. The other change that occurred was in the early termination fees. In actually May of last year, Verizon announced they were going to begin prorating early termination fees. I think Mike mentioned that. Then what we did is the industry, AT&T and others, followed, and we announced changes in October and in November saying we were also going to be implementing changes. Now, I want everyone to understand We announced it last fall. We are in the process of changing our systems, and we are anticipating those changes with the various carriers to occur sometime between second quarter and the end of this year. So we're in the process of addressing that issue, which was another major concern that we heard here today. The other items that I wanted to just cover briefly are the unintended consequences of this bill, because many of our sales channels are impacted. I think that the Attorney General, when they stated earlier, the Assistant Attorney General, they do not mean for it to be impacted. But what I'd like to do is just walk you through a couple and then actually use today's bill draft to point you to the language as to why I'm actually saying this. And the first one I'd like to talk about is our prepaid calling, our prepaid phones, okay? I did a little work last week while I was here in Minnesota, and I went to Sam's, I went to Walgreens, and I went to Walmart. I actually purchased this phone at Walmart. This is a prepaid phone. It's a phone that it's the grab-and-go phone that we all talked about, okay? And then what you do is you have this phone, and then you can activate it, and then you buy these cards, which have additional minutes on it, and that's what you add to get your additional minutes, okay? So when a customer buys these phones, and when I bought it in Walmart and when I looked at it in Walgreens, you know, there were no salespeople there to help me understand what I was buying, okay? There's information on the phone here on the back that tells you the rates and the various options on the rates. When you open it up, and took me a little while to get that open. Here's the user guide, okay? And in the user guide on the very first page of what, you know, it's ready, set. The first thing we tell you on set is you need to review the terms of service, which is your contract. When you activate this phone, you are agreeing to abide by the terms of service. They are then the rest of this, okay? And it covers basically the same items that are there. Okay, so that's how a customer knows what the rules are for this phone.
Ms. Brown, you don't actually have a contract with a client or with a consumer when you purchase one of these phones, though, do you?
Yes, you do. This
basically, they understand that they have so many minutes and that they plug in as many minutes as they buy.
Right. But what the contract covers, okay, the terms of service, which is the same document that Senator Anderson has when we sell it on a postpaid basis, okay, covers the same things. It's how will your minutes be rated? Will they be in full minutes? Will they be in partial minutes? What happens if you lose your phone? What can you expect from us as a company? What do we expect as you from the consumer? All of those terms of service, which is our contract with our customer, that is what's in this phone. This is what's in this book. And I'll be happy to, you can read it. I've tabbed them, and it tells you where the terms is, too. And you can actually have that. But I think it's important to understand this is a contract. Most folks don't think of it as a contract, but it is a contract. This is what is governing the relationship from the individual that has this phone and the company. It's what gives us our liability limitations. It's what gives the customer who purchased this what they can expect from us as a company. That's what our contract has in it, whether it's prepaid, postpaid. So when you go to the bill itself, and why I say I'm concerned about this product in the marketplace, if you go to the delete all amendment, the A1 amendment, in subdivision 2 under required disclosures, in subdivision 1, A1, it says that we must provide the customer at the time of sale a coverage map. When I went to Walmart and I went to Walgreens, there were no coverage maps for these products. Most customers, when they purchase these phones, they are going to Walgreens or Walmart because they know they want them. They've done the homework. Are they available for customers? Yes, but they're not available at the point of sale. So if this bill's passed, the sales experience and what Walgreens, Walmart will have to do will change. Now, when you go buy one of these at one of our retail outlets, yes, there are maps. And, you know, when we worked on this bill, we were looking at it from the point of sale at our locations. That's what we had in our mind that we were covering. But that's why I'm saying this bill goes beyond that. The bill also says that we must disclose, if you go down to A2, at the time of sale, we must give them the sales price of the service. No one talked to me when I bought this phone. It's here, but this says that I have to clearly and conspicuously disclose the price at the time the customer purchases it. Is this sufficient? I'm not sure, because what we've been told is, how will that be interpreted? Then you have to give a good faith estimate of the taxes. Well, there's nothing on this document about taxes. You go on further, and if the price is not guaranteed to remain the same, which it does say that in this document, when you add more minutes to this phone, if you buy them today at 10 cents and tomorrow when you buy your new card, they're 15 cents, this terms of service is what is governing the new card. It says so on the back of it. But so we have to tell our customers, we're not guaranteeing that when you buy and it says 10 cents here, that that's going to be forever. This requires us to tell customers that, and later on in it, it requires us to get a written acknowledgement. Or it doesn't say written, I'm sorry, it says on line 2.7, a specific acknowledgement. So now the customer who used to go into Walgreens and buy this no longer has that option available. Because we either have to change the sales process at Walgreens, and every sales clerk that rings them up has to be able to answer these questions and perform all of these functions in Minnesota. The next thing I'm going to talk about briefly is business customers. We have contracts with 3M, which I think was mentioned earlier. I think Senator Senjem actually brought this up. In that instance, what this bill requires, again, remember it says that we have to provide at the time of sale all of these items. Well, we may sell the business contract to 3M in New Jersey for their employees that operate here in Minnesota. We sell them a contract. We do not provide a coverage map for each of those individual phones when we send those out. We have what comes in our package, and in some of our phones, yes, we do have those. We have some coverage maps, but not all of them. So when we, because that's a different item when you're coming into our retail outlets, part of our contract is our coverage maps. We have a document. It's not one of those tapes that come out of a machine, but there's actually a two-page document. It's our customer service summary and the terms of service. That's our contract with our customer. We don't send, and that has everything that's in this bill, not in the right fonts, and there's some concerns there. But what we don't send that out on a business phone. Do we have to now? Well, when we sell business phones in the state of Minnesota, because it tells us that we have to do this at the time of sale. Well, at the time of sale isn't when we enter into that contract, because each of those individual phones have contracts. So each of the individual phones, as our attorneys read this, would require us to perform these functions. We don't do that. So that's another problem that we have, and we're very concerned about. Again, unintended consequences that I don't believe that we're trying to close down the wireless business with this bill, but this is the way it's currently drafted causes problems. A couple other areas that have been touched on, and I won't go into detail. Internet sales, Amazon.com, when they sell our products, when you go to BestBuy.com, what is the experience? There's a TradeMyCellular.com. There's many different ways to purchase phones other than what we really anticipated here. But yet, this bill is written so broadly that it requires us on every transaction to do these various items. And so it's a question. Do we need to do that? Is that your intent? Because if it is, then we are going to have to modify our processes here in the state of Minnesota. And that, again, will increase the cost. And I don't know the answers. I don't know what is wanted here. But it's a discussion we need to have. The last thing I'm going to talk about, we also have wholesale contracts. I'm not going to go through those. Best Buy, we have contracts with them and how they do business as well. And in the interest of time, I'm going to cut that one short. But again, the same concerns, the same discussions have to be had, because all of this is required as written, and it will modify how we do business in this state. The last item I want to talk about just briefly is third-party sales, or third-party, as we refer to them in here, third-party services. We've always said, when we had these discussions last year, that third-party services were a major concern to us because of the emerging technologies. Who would have thought 5 years ago that we would be watching TV on a cell phone, buying ringtones, voting for American Idol? And I think that's what was envisioned. But we've got some new technologies that we are working on, pilots programs. One's a pilot program that I'd like to share with you. The other one is something that I was just apprised of over the weekend, that's a new area in healthcare that we're working on that could be impacted by this bill. We are working a pilot project with U.S. Bank in the state of Washington right now, where you can actually put a chip in your cell phone, which would allow you to use your cell phone as a credit card. Some credit cards these days have like the RFID chip in them, where you can just wave it instead of swiping and you can be on your way. Well, we're working on a project right now where we put that chip in our phones and you actually activate your phone in order to make sure that it's not charged when you buy one of those and you're not purchasing something. But under this process, okay, then what happens is you purchase it, it gets billed to your cell phone bill. Under this bill, when you look at the subdivision 4, which deals with billing for third-party goods and services, it says that before we can bill anything to a bill, a cell phone bill, that we must obtain its prior express authorization. Okay. We and the project that's going on out there, that we have the proper financial arrangement set up just like you have on your credit card, but they don't fall within the definition of prior authorization. Again, a product, a technology that under this bill may not be available in Minnesota. That's a concern to us. The last one I'm going to mention is we're working with the healthcare community right now, an individual who has developed a chip that you can actually put in your heart that will monitor your heart, that will then, if your heart has problems and needs attention, it will then send a message to your doctor or a facility via wireless services. Then they can advise how best to, you know, what you should be doing. In this circumstance, we're not sure whether, because we, you know, all the billing arrangements, will, when all of that happens, will they bill for that on their cell phone bill? I don't know the answer to that. But I know some customers want one bill for things. That's the concern of, we're adopting language here that has unintended consequences. I know many of the things I've talked about today is not the intent of what the AG had when they offered this bill, but they are realities of this bill. And so what I would ask you is, we need to talk. We need to understand what the concerns are that this industry, our industry, has not addressed in this state. We've always said we're willing to sit down and visit about these items. But at the same time, I don't want to have Minnesota be on the map as, I can offer this everywhere but Minnesota, and I don't believe any of you do either. So I would hope that we don't just arbitrarily pass this bill out and say, we'll work on it later. Thank you for your time today, and if you have questions.
Ms. Brown,
yes.
Your 26 other states regulate the wireless industry. How do you operate in those 26 other states?
And when you say 26 other states regulate, could you help me with some clarification there?
The facts are that there are 25 states that don't, and there are 26. I'm assuming that it's something else. Okay, I'm sorry, I misspoke. I did misspeak about that. But you have been afforded the opportunity both with the AG's office, with my staff. We held a stakeholders meeting, and I had a meeting with you. And each time you were asked to provide some language that would remedy the problems that you saw, and nothing has ever been forthcoming. You've said that the language is too broad, but you've not come with any narrower language to us.
And I admit that, no, I have not. Here's my problem and why we have not come forth with language. I don't know what the decision is. Do you believe that the Go phone should be treated like a postpaid phone that has a contract? I don't know the answer to that. Do you believe that business contracts should be excluded or should they be included? I don't know the answer to that. Well, those are the discussions that have to be had.
But those are the discussions we've been trying to hold with you. And you need to offer that as a negotiating point if that's the case. But I get what I keep hearing is we just don't want to be regulated. We don't want to be regulated. And the other thing is I would think that you would be pleased that we're coming forward with this language now, especially as you're looking forward at things like using your phone as a credit card, that you would want to know what the standards are in the state and what the expectations are ahead of time before you start to use that type of a service. And I'm going to call Senator Olson up here to address some of this, too.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to thank you also for your work on this bill and the attention that you've paid to this issue and your attempts to work with the industry. I would have to say that this is the first time I've ever heard expressed to me specifically the concerns that the cell phone industry has in this kind of detail, and the first time I heard it at all was just last week. I think some of these things, from my perspective, really are kind of red herring arguments. When it comes to things like using your phone as a credit card or wanting to have your health care bills put on your cell phone bill or anything like that, it would seem to me that would be a situation where you'd certainly would want consumers to have some documentation that they've consented to that type of use of your phone before you just started adding those things to your bill. But as long as they have been made aware and they've consented and you have their authorization, there's nothing in this bill that prevents any of that from happening. So I think that's just a red herring argument that we're somehow going to be not allowed to have the advantage of new technology. We're certain, but all the more reason to make sure when we're starting to add these other kinds of things to someone's bill that consumers actually have that information beforehand and know that that's going to be happening.
Okay. Before you go on, Senator Olson, though, I need to ask the committee if there are any questions of Ms. Brown so we can dismiss her if that's the case. Senator Dibble.
Well, Madam Chair, I listened to the testimony very, very closely, and I guess my only question is, do you feel like all of the issues that you raised as grave concerns have solutions or fairly simple solutions that could be worked out in conversation with the AG's office and with Senator Olson or not?
I think that it is. We have always said that we would entertain conversations. I know that we tried to meet with Senator Olson. We actually did have a meeting, but, schedules are very, very busy, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate the time we did get to talk. I think that when you look at these issues, there's some fundamental decisions in these process, for all of these issues. My concern is we worked very hard last year. What else are we not thinking of? This technology is blowing past us. And what I keep asking and the question I keep struggling with is, what problem are we addressing here? Have we heard problems? Yes, I heard two consumers here today talk about problems. Our industry has released information on modified practices which actually address those concerns. Okay, so have we had problems? Has this industry had problems? Yes, we're growing, and we're growing exponentially. We are offering new technologies, new ideas, new innovation in this marketplace. Do we have some startup problems along the way? Yes, every industry does. Are we addressing them? I believe we are. And if we're not, then yes, let's sit down, identify where we aren't, and let's figure out what we need to do. If it's if legislation is the right answer, then we're willing to entertain that. I have yet to hear, though, what will be solved with legislation that we as an industry have not already tried to address ourselves.
Senator Dibble.
I'm not sure what the answer was, Madam Chair, but but I think the testimony and the bill presents itself very clearly, you know, that we're looking for some clear disclosure and some even-handed treatment of consumers. Just listening to the testimony, I can think of some very, very simple solutions to all of these insurmountable barriers that were presented. So, you know, I'd love to have the conversation with Senator Olson and you. I think we can solve these with very simple solutions and come up with a bill that works for everyone. I know that the industry has had quite a bit of time. I became aware of the mywireless.org, full court press to try to kill this bill, you know, ramping up a number of months ago. I think the industry is here simply to try to kill the bill. I think that's unfortunate. And I would rather see an amicable resolution that serves our common interest, which is your customer base.
Okay. Any further questions of the testifier? Okay. Thank you, Ms. Brown.
Welcome. I'll leave these. These were the press releases on our change practices. So if the committee would like them, I'll leave them here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I just would make one additional comment with regard to that. I live in northern Minnesota, where we only have one company that really has good coverage right now. And I'm not aware that they've accepted or adopted these practices. I don't believe they have. Without this type of legislation, we're not going to have uniform treatment around the state. We're not going to, and I think as the Attorney General's office testified, we're still continuing to see no decrease in the number of consumer complaints and problems that we've had for many, many years.
Okay. Anything further? Senator Rosen?
I would just like to concur with Senator Dibble as far as his offer to get with Senator Olson and work out some of these changes before we move forward with this bill. I think that would be a prudent, thoughtful manner.
Senator Rosen, the bill does have to be heard before Commerce and Judiciary, so there is plenty of opportunity to address some of those issues.
And Madam Chair, I'm very willing. As I said, I asked the industry when they met with me to propose some language, and it was clear that they didn't intend to do that or to offer anything specific that would address these issues that they're raising. I can think of some ideas too, but I have no indication from the industry that would satisfy their concerns other than to simply just make this bill go away. If they really do want to sit down with any of us who are interested and talk about some simple solutions, I'd be more than happy to have those discussions with them as this goes forward.
Okay, thank you. Is there a motion? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I will move that Senate File 833, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Judiciary.
Commerce.
Okay.
Any discussion on the motion?
Madam Chair.
Senator Sanchez.
Is a motion to table a superior motion?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I would move to table this and instruct the author to certainly work with the industry, get Senator Dibble involved if he so likes, and give it a time. You're the chair. You can bring this bill back anytime. But let this work a little bit, because I think there are some things that were pointed out today that need to be addressed, and simply passing it on to Commerce. I almost feel like personally got too much invested in this bill already, having sat through this hearing, and I want to hear it back. So I would hope that you would,
Madam Chair,
that we could table this and bring it back.
Madam Chair,
and
Senator Senchum can't argue his own motion. The motion to table is not debatable.
Well, I tried. I got my comments in. Thank you.
I just asked that question, and I was
not told. Debatable on either side.
It is a non-debatable motion, and there is a motion to table. So all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No. No.
Division.
Okay. All those in favor? The clerk will take the roll.
Oh, it's just division.
Okay, division. I'm sorry. All those in favor, raise your hands. Opposed. What was the first one?
Six.
Oh, the motion fails. It was 6-7 division.
Sorry, I renew my motion.
So you renew your motion. Any discussion on the motion? Then all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed?
Nay.
No.
The motion prevails. And that is all the business before our committee today. Meeting is adjourned.
I've seen it worked out. You come back to our committee.
Do, yeah.
That was a good idea.
Sure they
did. Did you turn it off?
Yeah, I got to get home. My kids are
they don't believe
wandering to the neighborhood.
Radio.
No.